You know, I think the thing about hummingbirds that still fascinates is they can fly backwards and forwards. They look like they're not really anything at all. They're these little flying jewels.
Did you know that hummingbirds inspired some of the 19th century's greatest writers? From Emily Dickinson to Mark Twain? We'll tell you the story in a few minutes. But first, David Gessner is a nature writer who's sick of nature. Sick of trees, sick of birds, sick of the ocean, or at least sick of the tone of hushed reverence we use to write about them. Gessner calls that tone the gentle straitjacket of the nature writing genre. As a writer himself and editor of an environmental literary magazine called Ecotone, Gessner tries to practice what he preaches. In a recent essay called My Green Manifesto, he makes the case for wilder, messier, more eccentric writing. He told Steve Paulson that for too many writers today, nature is like your great aunt, treated with way too much reverence.
I recently called it a genre with hardened arteries, and some of those conventions get tiresome because they're conventions and therefore lack surprise and they're predictable. I want language that breaks out and has wildness, which is one of the reasons we go to nature in the first place, is for things that are wild and surprising. And it's funny how nature writing, which particularly in this time where it's, you know, green everything, you'd think it would be enjoying kind of a rebirth, but it seems kind of marginalized. And I think part of the reason of that, it's about as sexy as quilting right now.
Well, who do you see as some of the greatest nature writers out there, either past or present?
One of the conventions of the genre, of course, is quoting Thoreau. But what I love about Thoreau, the interesting Thoreau to me, is almost kind of the artist who creates this character that's conflicted. You've got a chapter called Higher Laws.
You're talking about in Thoreau's Walden.
In Walden, yeah. You've got a chapter called Higher Laws where Thoreau, you know, basically shudders daintily at all these imperfections of man and the muddy human being. But then in the middle of that, he suddenly sees a woodchuck going across and he wants to basically mug it and devour it for the wildness it represented. I loved that moment because it showed this conflicted, contrary human being. A very similar, more contemporary moment occurs in Ed Abbey's Desert Solitaire when he's in Arches and he's sitting on his trailer with a cup of coffee. He's sitting in the stoop outside his trailer, basking in the sun with a cup of coffee, and he's having this kind of transcendent moment. And a rabbit goes by, and impulsively he tosses a rock at the rabbit, which is, you know, totally bizarre, inappropriate, but beautiful because it's not the nature saint, you know, quietly sitting there meditating. It's this conflicted, strange person, which brings with it interest.
Well, it's fascinating what you're saying. I mean, you're raising a couple of points here. One is that there's something about nature in its true wildness that's pretty threatening to us. To really be immersed in that can be overwhelming.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think that's one of the complicated ways we should write about it, and the language we should use should be complicated.
Well, the other thing that these examples suggest is you're trying to put the human back into nature. Nature writing is not just a matter of sort of describing this pristine wilderness as if people aren't there. People actually are there observing this and often experiencing it.
Yeah, there has to be a human story. Since humans are reading it, skunks and chipmunks aren't reading it, humans are reading it. There has to be a human story to pull the readers into this world where they can experience the natural world. An example in my own work, I had a book called Return of the Osprey. And I'd recently recovered from testicular cancer. At the same time, ospreys had recently come back to Cape Cod after being all but wiped out by DDT. And I was learning about these birds, and it was so personally thrilling to me. And I watched the season as the birds mated, the young hatched, they started to fledge and fly. I watched the whole cycle, and it was this kind of monomaniacal immersion in the birds. But when I went to putting it in a book, I thought, boy, these are facts are going to be very dry for the average reader, you know, to read all these things that were so fascinating to me. So I kind of created a character who happened to be myself, who got immersed in that and got excited about it and got monomaniacal about it. And I think, or at least I hope, that that's the reader's entry into the natural world.
When you say you created a character, which was you, are you saying you made up that character to some degree, or was this all true, what you wrote about yourself?
Well, of course, we're not allowed to say these things in the age of James Frey, right? But as a nonfiction writer, you are always creating that character to some degree. You know, I always say, would have been scary if Thoreau was put on Oprah, because her first question would be, you say you spent a year in the woods, and it's no, it's actually 2 years and change compressed into a year. You know, there are all these aspects of creative nonfiction where we're building and creating the characters in the books. There's a difference between that and outright fabrication, obviously.
Didn't Thoreau also go back for regular meals with his mother?
Yeah, he gets a lot of flack for that one. But, you know, he went back on Sunday sometime and did his laundry. But I think the whole symbolic importance of going there was this great kind of artistic solution to his life. You know, there's a reason the first chapter is called Economy. The big pressing question for him and so many young artists is, how do I live while I'm doing this thing? How do I survive? And he basically did it by, you know, cutting down on everything he possibly could and focusing on the natural world and the work.
And that's instructive because it really was a book about himself in a way. I mean, it's about his own grappling with how to live in the world, but it, by doing that, it was a celebration of nature.
You know, there's that line on the first page of Walden, which is basically, I wouldn't talk about myself if there were anyone else I knew as well, which is a great line for the age of memoir, too. But I think the use of memoir in nature writing is a great opportunity because, you know, memoir gets knocked pretty hard these days. But whatever you want to say about it, it's interesting to learn about someone else's life. And if you can thread that life into writing about the natural world, you get a great combination of looking inward toward the self and outward toward the world. And that, for me, is really exciting writing.
Isn't one of the occupational hazards of nature writing that you're, for the most part, preaching to the choir? I mean, ostensibly, you're out there trying to convince people to save nature, to save the natural world, but pretty much the people who are going to read your stuff already believe that.
That's exactly that. You just, you know, hit the nail on the head there. That is a great problem with the genre, and I just wrote a piece called My Green Manifesto, and one of the things I'm trying to say in there is we've got to use everything we can, humor, bluntness, everything non-naturey, you know, just anything to like stir people who aren't naturally going to be interested in this sort of thing. And the whole idea for me is to mix things up again and get the language muddied and get it out of that little ghetto of nature writing.
Now, we were talking earlier about wildness, and that's an idea that Thoreau wrote about and a lot of other people have written about since. What does wildness mean to you?
Well, it's been pointed out by quite a few people that it's constantly misquoted, Thoreau's famous quote as, in wilderness is the preservation of the world. You know, it's in wildness is the preservation of the world. And I think that's so important. And one of the reasons it's important is we get kind of the nature calendar view of nature where we think wilderness is in Alaska, wilderness is the Himalayas, wilderness is some other place. And what wildness means to me is the possibility of states beyond the human and moments where we interact with species other than our own in our lives, in our normal, you know, I always say my greatest nature moments have been on Cape Cod watching humpback whales off my home beach. And that's greater than any when I've traveled to South or Central America. There was something wild about it happening at home. Similarly, I've had wild moments where, you know, I was with my dad when he died and hearing his breathing slow, and I was with my daughter when she was born. And these are wild moments too. So for me, the key to wildness is its integration with our so-called normal lives, that it's not something we go to beyond our quotidian day-to-day lives. I mean, I guess wildness is ineffable. You know, it's a state that we all define differently that's, you know, beyond the predictable, beyond the boring, beyond the everyday. And for me, you know, humor gets at wildness. That's why I'm not emphasizing humor in nature writing because I think it should be yuck, yuck, you know, big jokes all the time. But I think humor, if you actually go camping or backpacking with people, it's amazing how, you know, somebody's always got a bottle of something. You're always drinking a little bit. Jokes are flying. It's a much more exhilarating and free-for-all experience than the experience of, you know, this image of kind of the tight-lipped, serious, earnest nature people.
David Gessner talked with Steve Paulson. Gessner's books include Sick of Nature and Soaring with Fidel, an Osprey Odyssey from Cape Cod to Cuba and beyond. And you can read his Green Manifesto online at Ecotone. Visit our website for the link.